Welcome to the show. On today's episode, we have Ben Tanner. He's been a practicing physician assistant in emergency medicine, urgent care, and family practice since 2014. Since 2016, he's developed an avid interest in various forms of fasting, using it to improve his own health while helping friends, family, and patients do the same. And this episode, we'll be talking about fasting with high blood pressure, fasting and high cholesterol, fasting and prediabetes and diabetes. This is a great episode, so please enjoy. Before we head into today's episode, I am so excited to share some details with you from today's sponsor, Dr. Stephen Cabral, board-certified doctor of naturopathy and author of The Rain Barrel Effect, whom I've had on the show in the past. He has a really incredible offer for listeners today, and that is a complete mineral and metals at-home lab test kit and health coaching call for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. The state-of-the-art at-home health test allows you to discover your underlying root cause for high stress, brain fog, weight gain, headaches, skin rashes, poor sleep, inflammation, and so much more. No needles or blood required. Just a few snips of hair and you can discover your mineral deficiencies and heavy metal toxicities such as arsenic, aluminum, cadmium, and mercury. Once results are received, you will get a free consultation with one of Dr. Cabral's health coaches who will help you understand your results and provide you with a personalized wellness plan to take back control of your health and rebalance your body. Again, this is a limited time offer. Dr. Cabral is providing the lab test and consultation to my listeners for free. You just pay shipping and handling. This is a $299 value. So head on over to stephencabral.com/cat, K-A-T, to reserve your test today. Welcome to the Kat Kativi Podcast, your source for all things health, happiness, and beauty. Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for being with us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So today we're going to be talking about fasting and high blood pressure. But before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you became a physician assistant and where your interest in fasting first began?
Yeah, sure. So I took a long meandering road to my current profession as well as my other current projects. So originally I wanted to be a foot doctor, which is called a podiatrist. And I went to podiatry school for a while. And then I eventually, while I was there, I learned about the physician assistant career path. And I did some rotations there where I got exposed to various medical specialties and decided, this is a cool idea because if I were a PA or a physician assistant, then I could work in basically any medical specialty and even switch specialties periodically if I wanted to for some reason. And so I ultimately changed and decided to be a PA instead. So it was over several years, of course, that all of this happened. And then eventually I, you know, went to PA school and graduated and started working in the emergency room because when I had done that rotation during PA school, I thought it was really cool and like doing procedures and I liked the fast pace and things of that nature. And I did some family practice and urgent care as well. But it was after about three or four years of working as a PA.
Hi, this is Dr. Stephen Cabral, and I want to thank Kat for allowing me to share with all of you something we've now been able to help over 250,000 people around the world with. This is state-of-the-art at-home health testing that enables you to discover your underlying root cause reasons for your higher stress, poor sleep, lower mood, lower energy, low libido, low ambition, weight gain, inflammation, and so much more. This at-home lab testing is easy to complete with just a few snips of hair to discover your nutritional deficiencies as well as your heavy metal toxicities such as arsenic, mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and more. Once your results are mailed in, you'll then be able to speak with one of my certified health coaches to truly understand your results, and you'll receive a personalized wellness plan to take back control of your health and rebalance your body. As a limited time offer for Kat's audience, we are offering your first at-home lab test completely free, where you just pay for the shipping and handling. This lab has helped so many people around the world, and I'd love to be able to introduce you to it as well. For details, go to stephencabral.com/Kat.
That I kind of stumbled into some videos and some podcast episodes. It was because I was following one person who doesn't usually talk about things like fasting, but he happened to have a couple guests that talked about ketogenic diet and fasting. And the guests were people who do a lot of research and really know their stuff. And so they had some interesting points to share. And so it was just one thing led to another. And I started learning more about it, started trying it myself, and thought it was a really powerful tool that could help a lot of people.
Yeah, I remember when I first heard about fasting, it was the same way, listening to podcasts, one thing leads to another. Somebody comes on and I'm just like, interesting. Because I had always been fasting without knowing it. I was just too lazy to eat sometimes. And I would just try to stuff it all into a few hours just for time management. And everybody said, that's so unhealthy. And now it seems to be the thing to do. Yay me.
Yeah, that's a good point, because most of us, most people have been told that they need to eat all the time. And if they do anything different, they're kind of told either, well, explicitly, or it's just kind of implied that that's going to be unhealthy and, you know, that's a problem. But some people do it kind of naturally. And I think if we hadn't been told, for example, that breakfast is the most important meal of the day and that we need to eat all the time and eat all day, then a lot more people would probably do it naturally. They wouldn't feel obligated, you know, just eat at the very beginning of the day, for example.
Yeah, that's one that I've constantly heard, especially when I was younger and I just never ate breakfast. And they were always like, you're going to die. And I'm like, I don't know, I feel fine. But yeah, that's definitely something that we've been told. And then I heard, oh, you have to eat within 20 minutes. And I'm trying to think, like, how could a species survive if they have to eat between in 20 minutes of waking up?
Yeah, it's not very likely that our ancestors were doing that all the time.
So let's get into high blood pressure. What causes high blood pressure?
Well, it's one of those things that's definitely multifactorial, meaning there's multiple things, a number of things that can contribute to it. But based on some research I've done recently, I think there's one primary or main underlying cause that's the main one in the majority of cases nowadays, and that is something called insulin resistance. So I read a book maybe about a year ago. I'd have to look at the timeline, but it's called Why We Get Sick. Why We Get Sick by Dr. Ben Bickman. He's a PhD researcher and he's an expert on insulin. And in that book, he made the case that insulin resistance, which I'll explain in just a second, is one of the main underlying causes of many different chronic diseases, including high blood pressure. So basically, insulin is a hormone that comes from your pancreas. Whenever you eat carbohydrates in particular, any type of carbohydrates, you know, be it grains or sugar or what have you, potatoes, etc. And it comes into your bloodstream when you eat those carbs and helps push the carbs, usher the carbs out of your bloodstream. If you're someone who's eating a lot of processed carbs and eating them very frequently, then you get a lot of blood sugar spikes. And whenever you get those blood sugar spikes, your insulin also goes up and has a spike of its own. And if that happens too often, then the body says, whoa, 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 that's too much insulin. So the body has to turn down the response to the insulin. And so then you end up with higher blood sugar. And because you have higher blood sugar, your pancreas secretes even more insulin and it becomes basically a vicious cycle. And so based on Dr. Bickman's research in his book, the majority of adults in the United States have insulin resistance, which means they have excessively high levels of insulin. And whenever that's the case, one of the things that happens, and sorry, this is a long explanation, but whenever you have excessively high insulin levels, one of the things that happens is that your kidneys retain more salt and water. They hold on to more salt. And so water comes with the salt and there's more stuff in your bloodstream, which means more pressure. So there are other causes, of course, but I think based on the modern food environment and how common it is for people to have insulin resistance, that's probably the number one cause nowadays of high blood pressure. And a couple other things would be like higher stress levels, which increase the amount of adrenaline and also the long-term stress hormone called cortisol in your bloodstream. Also, not getting enough sleep would be another cause of high blood pressure, because another book I read not too long ago, I think it's called Why We Sleep by Dr. Matthew Walker. He talked about that in one of the chapters, was that one of the things your body does during a good night's sleep is it does some things in your vascular system to relax it more, and it helps moderate your blood pressure. But if you don't get enough sleep, then that doesn't happen. And then your blood pressure is higher. And also your stress hormones are higher. The stress hormone levels are higher if you don't get enough sleep or don't get good quality sleep. So those are a few lifestyle things that can potentially contribute. And then once in a while, people have really rare causes of high blood pressure that have to be, you know, investigated through various medical tests and things like that. But those are some of the more common things that contribute.
So I want to go over a few of them. So the insulin resistance one, my mom claims she has, and she's a nurse, so she should know better, that she has the genetic type of high blood pressure because she's had it since she was very young, whatever. But I'm not buying that. She also doesn't sleep very well. She's a nurse, so she works 12-hour shifts, and then she wants to relax, and so she doesn't get much sleep. And then she eats candy. She has candy. I haven't had a candy in decades. I don't even remember what a candy is like. Like, how can you even eat a candy in this day and age? But she'll just be like, oh, it's fine. And then she talks about how healthy she is. So I'm wondering how many of those genetic people are just lying to themselves.
Yeah, I'm sure, like I said at the beginning of that spiel, it's multifactorial. So you can have a genetic predisposition to a lot of things, including high blood pressure, but that doesn't mean your fate is sealed. You don't have to continue to have high blood pressure just because you're a little bit more predisposed. It also depends a lot on lifestyle factors. So we can blame our genetics for a lot of things, but usually we can also, like when it comes to things like high blood pressure or even type 2 diabetes, for example, we don't have to just accept it. We can certainly do enough to correct it through lifestyle.
Yeah, especially since before it wasn't as common and we all basically had the same genetics, and now it's more common.
Yeah, that's a good point. So that's if we look at the timeline of like when people have been getting diabetes, for example, because type 2 diabetes, which is the more common type of diabetes, is basically a result of or comes along with having too much insulin, or in other words, insulin resistance. So they go hand in hand. So the diabetes and this modern version of high blood pressure, which is generally caused by high insulin as well. So I don't know the exact timeline, but certainly if you were to look at a graph through in the early 1900s, hardly anybody had diabetes. In the mid 1900s, a few more people as we started eating more sugar in our diet. And then in the late 1900s, it's gone up like crazy. And in the 2000s, it's continued to go up. So it's a really dramatic increase in diabetes over the past several decades. And the high blood pressure or hypertension kind of follows that as well to some extent, though probably not quite as dramatic.
So this podcast topic is also, because when I arranged it with you, I had perfect blood pressure and everything. But then I started taking this medication, spironolactone, and it's a diuretic. And I looked it up, and apparently it raises your blood pressure. And it has, since I've been using it for now 6 months, I tested it, it was getting high. And then a year I tested it, it's getting even higher. And I'm like, this is not a good trajectory. So I want to keep taking it because the benefits of it are very, very good. I get clear skin. That's important to people. But for these, okay, I also read that beta blockers, prednisone, and some birth control can also raise your blood pressure. So for those of us that are on medications, but maybe we want to be on the medications because it makes other things easier to handle, is there anything that those people can do to get their levels better?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So say if you're doing something else, like you said, like taking a medication that maybe the purpose of the medication isn't to lower your blood pressure, if you're taking it for something else, but then maybe as a side effect, it might be raising your blood pressure. Then I think the answer is basically all of the lifestyle things that can help to improve blood pressure, that you can try all of those things and see what happens and do it as an experiment. Because sometimes the medication might be optional or might be something where you could lower the dose or what have you. And so you can experiment with yourself and see how it goes. So there's the potential dietary changes if somebody needs that. I think a really important one is lowering the amount of sugar and processed carbs that somebody's consuming. Exercise also helps. It helps to lower blood pressure because like in the short term, while you're exercising, of course, your blood pressure is higher, but then your body's adaptation to that is to kind of have lower blood pressure overall. Mindfulness helps because we talked about stress being a cause of increased blood pressure to some extent. and then good quality sleep, which, you know, if you can relax, if you can be mindful and then get good quality sleep, then that's going to help as well. And then the elephant in the room is people are generally told to lower their salt intake, but that doesn't help most people. That's well known in the medical community that only a small percentage of people that see their blood pressure go down if they lower their salt intake. And there's a case to be made that people should not lower their salt intake in most cases. There's a whole book about this called The Salt Fix, which people can look at if they want to know more about it. But basically, lowering salt indirectly raises some stress hormones because the body has to compensate then. Because if you don't have enough salt in your bloodstream, the body has to figure out some way to raise your blood pressure just a little bit because of that lack of salt. And so it increases the stress hormones. Anyway, so that's going on off on various different things. But the point was, if you have something coming into your life that's kind of raising your blood pressure, you can try to take advantage of certain lifestyle changes to try to compensate for that or reverse that, and then see what happens, because you never know. Like, it might normalize or it might not, and then you might have to consider other options. And of course, I didn't bring up fasting and all of that, but that's another like lifestyle related thing that can affect blood pressure.
And let's go back. So what are the typical treatments for high blood pressure? Like, say you go to your doctor, a regular doctor, what are they going to give you, and how well do these treatments work?
Yeah, good question. So the approach that you're taught to use when you're in medical school is to start with diet and lifestyle. But you're told to do that, but you're not really told what that means very well. So that'd be like, eat healthy. But again, like, if your doctor tells you to eat healthy, they usually don't give you a great explanation about what that means. A, because they don't have enough time because they're in a big rush. And B, because maybe they don't have a really good grasp of what would be the healthiest way to eat. So eat healthy in general. Exercise, they would tell you to exercise probably. And then if that doesn't work, or if you just want to skip some steps, then they would start you on a medication. And there's a few common categories of medications. And of course, anyone who has high blood pressure is familiar with some of them probably. But usually what the medications are doing are either trying to lower your stress response a little bit. So that's like beta blockers, for example, or open up your blood vessels a little bit, like calcium channel blockers, for example, or try to get you to basically urinate out more salt and water so that you won't have as much stuff in your bloodstream. And so ACE inhibitors are an example, and other diuretics as well. So that's the typical treatment. If you put somebody on enough medications, you can usually get their blood pressure down. But the medications do have potential side effects, and so it's not always the best thing to have to be on them, basically.
So what are some other complications for having high blood pressure? What types of problems do we see in the emergency room related to this?
Yeah, a lot of things. So one of the most common things people think about, well, I don't know if people think about this, but as an ER provider, one of the most common things we see and the common things we think about is somebody with chest pain who might be having a heart attack, right? So when you talk to somebody who has chest pain and you're trying to decide, well, how likely is it that they're having a heart attack right now? One of the questions you ask is, well, do you have other medical problems like diabetes or high blood pressure? And if they do, then you know they're at a higher risk of having a heart attack or similar problems. So heart disease is a major one where blood pressure contributes to it. Like, you can't say, oh, that's the reason they had a heart attack, but there's a strong correlation. And then another one, which is kind of a more direct connection, would be people that have the type of stroke where they bleed in their brain, or where they have like spontaneous bleeding somewhere else in their body sometimes. Sometimes they have out of control high blood pressure when that happens, which makes sense, you know, just intuitively, that if you have this really high blood pressure, it's like pushing on the walls of your arteries. And then if they already have what's called an aneurysm, where the walls of the arteries are kind of expanded in an unnatural way, then that makes them more likely to have that sudden bleeding, but also the high blood pressure makes them more likely to have it. So if you have both, then that's a bad combination. And then another one is, and this is one most people don't think much about at all, which is kidney failure. So a lot of people have kidney failure, and those people end up in the emergency room more often than people without kidney failure. And sometimes we see young people whose kidneys don't work anymore, and they're on dialysis. So they have to go usually 3 times a week for about 4 hours each time to get this dialysis treatment. And so sometimes I'll look at their medical chart or ask them, like, well, do you know what caused your kidneys to stop working? And it's usually one of two things. It's usually either diabetes or high blood pressure, or both. When they have this, sometimes they're immigrants who haven't had, you know, adequate kind of medical supervision, medical care over the years. So that's common where we see those people. At my first ER job, every day we had about 10 undocumented immigrants that would come into the ER to get their dialysis because they had nowhere else to go. So they couldn't really get like medical insurance or whatever, and they couldn't afford medical care because they were pretty poor. But they would just come into the ER and get it. And we knew they were never going to pay for it, basically. but we did it. We just like arranged it for them. And in almost every case, it was because of either diabetes or high blood pressure that had kind of contributed to their kidneys not working anymore. So those are some really common things. And there are a bunch of other things that blood pressure can contribute to, other health problems that high blood pressure can contribute to. But those are just like really common things that can be really devastating as well.
Mm. So I just realized that I misspoke earlier. The medication that I was on does not increase my blood pressure. It increased my cholesterol.
Okay. Okay.
Oops.
So yeah, you said, did you say spironolactone?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like thinking in the back of my brain, like, I think it might be the opposite of what you're saying, but yeah, I didn't want to like interrupt you.
No, you can call me out. Sometimes I mess up.
Yeah. No, fair enough. But yes, me too. So I didn't want to like make a scene about that, but fair enough.
Yeah. What is the correlation between the blood pressure and cholesterol? What is the mechanism? How does that work on each other?
Oh, the connection between those. I guess you could say that there doesn't have to be a connection, but some of the things that contribute to high blood pressure can also contribute to having, I mean, high cholesterol is a really vague term that we use because there's several different like components of what we call a lipid panel or a cholesterol panel, and some of them are more important than others. And then there are other kind of more specific tests that you don't always get that would tell you a little bit more about whether it matters that you have high cholesterol, for instance. But if we want to connect the two, there is a bit of a connection between having poor cholesterol numbers and high blood pressure connected to both to various lifestyle factors. So some of the same things we talked about. So definitely like a poor diet that, you know, we talked about like sugar and processed carbs, for example, not only will those contribute to higher blood pressure, but they contribute to a higher level, particularly of something called triglycerides. And triglycerides are one of the things that's measured on your cholesterol panel. And if you have high triglycerides, that's definitely a risk factor for heart disease and similar problems. So diet can affect both. And to some extent, things like poor sleep and stress and lack of exercise can have a negative impact on both to some extent, though it's not as obvious or direct of a connection in some cases with the cholesterol as it is with the blood pressure.
Yeah, I remember when I tried keto once. My levels were always fine for everything. And then my triglycerides spike like crazy. And then I'm like, no keto, no more. I don't know why. Some people are like, you have to push through that and then it'll get back down. But I didn't want to risk that.
Yeah. Was it your triglycerides or could it have been? Okay. Because it's common on keto to have high total cholesterol levels and high levels of what's called LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol. But the triglycerides, it's a little bit more common for that to go down. So maybe you were just not typical in that regard. Congrats. Just kidding.
We hear a lot about how losing weight can help with lowering cholesterol and diabetes, but I have friends that are very thin with super high cholesterol and blood pressure. And maybe not diabetes, but definitely insulin resistance because they get super hangry and cranky all the time. So does it really have to correlate with weight? And what about those thin people?
Yeah, so that's a good question as well, for sure. So basically, at the beginning, when I explained about insulin resistance and mentioned that the majority of adults have insulin resistance nowadays, most of those people that have insulin resistance are overweight, but not all of them. So you can certainly have excessively high insulin levels without being really noticeably overweight. Sometimes there's this kind of joking phrase that people use, which is skinny fat, right? But there's actually like I forget what the more technical medical term for that is. There's some acronym for it where it's like thin on the outside, fat on the inside or something. So there are those people that kind of fall into that category. And so they have some fat deposits around some of their internal organs, but it doesn't really come out as a big belly or just being really thick overall. But those people may have a metabolic underlying reason for their higher blood pressure, as well as the higher or like more dysregulated cholesterol levels as well. So yeah, you definitely don't have to be significantly overweight to have a metabolic cause or metabolic contributing factor to chronic illnesses like high blood pressure.
And I do remember when I was very young, I was incredibly thin. I would even say maybe underweight almost. I mean, I'm short, so it kind of was okay. But I was eating terrible and I was crashing all the time and I was a cranky little person. And I would eat a big loaf of bread, lots of pasta. I mean, that was my diet, bread, pasta. I was also running, but still I wasn't healthy. I see it now more because I can recognize it in other people where they just get cranky and they're like, I have to eat right now. And I'm just like, you never have to eat right now. You're not starving. You're fine. You can go for a couple hours. There has to be something wrong with those people.
Something wrong with the people the people that eat all the time or the people that don't want to eat?
Well, the people that they get really cranky if they haven't eaten hours.
The hangry thing.
Yeah, okay. Hangry.
Well, I think that is common, right? Because like if you go around and you tell people like, hey, it might be good for your health if you don't eat as often, or if you try some kind of fasting, then that's a really common response actually is, no, I couldn't do that. I'm going to get hangry, because they're used to eating. And then if they go more than like just a few hours after the meal without eating again, that then they start to feel a little off, like something's wrong. And I think the most common reason for that is, and actually read a book about this as well. It's called Always Hung by Dr. I think David Ludwig, who's a researcher at Harvard. So he wrote this whole book about how people, when they eat, you mentioned like bread and pasta, when they eat refined carbs, so it could be crackers, could be chips, all these snacks that are sugary or have processed flour or they're like potato products. When you eat that kind of stuff, you get the blood sugar spike. And because your blood sugar kind of skyrockets in the short term, it also comes crashing down when your insulin is released. So the insulin, what, like I said at the beginning, it pushes your blood sugar out of your bloodstream or ushers it out. So you get the blood sugar spike, then the insulin spike, and then the insulin spike causes the blood sugar to come crashing down. And then when it comes crashing down, it goes down to normal and then a little lower, as in, because it came down too fast, it goes slightly below normal, not dangerously low blood sugar or anything like that. It's pretty rare for a lot of people are like, oh, I'm hypoglycemic. And I usually am thinking like, well, you know, research has shown that's not really a thing. but so in other words, you can have uncomfortably low blood sugar, but you almost never get dangerously low blood sugar unless you're on a medication that causes it. But anyway, blood sugar spikes, crashing down, and then feeling, oh, wait, my blood sugar is a little lower than it should be. And then that's when you're like, okay, I got to eat something to fix that. And that's also kind of that hangry moment where you're like, ooh, I just feel a little off, a little, something's not quite right. That's where that blood sugar is, here's normal, and it's just a little bit below normal kind of thing.
Yeah. I remember in the mornings before, like we knew it was okay, I wasn't eating until sometimes 2 p.m. So I felt fine. I had tons of energy. In fact, I didn't even want to eat because I wanted to get all my work done because I had all that energy. And then I knew as soon as I ate, I would lose some energy, right? So I'm doing this. And then my husband's like, no, I'm going to check your blood sugar because there's no way. He checks it. And it's like, I forgot what it was, of course, but it was super low. And he's like, oh my God, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I feel great. I feel fine. So when you're fasting, or intermittent fasting, let's say, for a long time, can you have like a low blood sugar reading and like be totally fine if you feel fine?
Yeah. So yeah, that's a good question. And so I should probably put it in context just a little bit. So they defined the normal level of blood sugar as 70 to 100 when you're not eating. And that's the scale we use in the United States. In some other countries, they use a different scale, a different way of measuring it. But so 70 to 100, but that's based on like not eating for a few hours or maybe up to 8 hours or something, that generally they're saying like, oh, your blood sugar shouldn't be lower than 70. But that doesn't take into account people that fast for more than 8 hours or for like a whole day or sometimes even longer. It doesn't really take that into account because there's something that happens when you do a longer fast, and that's that your body starts to rely less on blood sugar for energy and for your, you know, brain's focus as well, and starts to use more fatty acids, or more fat, in other words, and it turns some of that fat into ketones, and ketones start to replace the blood sugar as an energy source. And so if you're, and I've done this several times where I've done a prolonged fast, which is multiple days. And if I do that and I check my blood sugar, then often it'll be what would be considered low, below 70 after a day or two, maybe after 2 days. And that's because while the blood sugar is kind of gradually dropping, the ketones are gradually rising. And they're, like I said, they're replacing the blood sugar as an energy source. It's less likely that your blood sugar would go very low if you're fasting for less than a day. It might go a little bit below the so-called normal level, but probably wouldn't be dangerous or anything. But it's more on those multi-day fasts where it could go quite low, where somebody could get alarmed that it's, wow, it's this low, but then maybe they're feeling fine. And that's because their ketones have come in, and the ketones are an alternative energy source for the brain in particular, but also for other parts of the body.
Yeah. Whenever we do a blood test on me, my ketones are always very high.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you said you tried a ketogenic diet at some point, but there were some issues, and so you didn't end up sticking with it?
Yeah, I did not do well with keto. Carnivore didn't get past very long because I just couldn't. And so now I do kind of a paleo-ish type of diet.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, interesting. Yeah, so like paleo can sometimes be pretty low carb. It just depends on which, you know, version or which things you're including. So maybe that has something to do with it if your ketones are high when you get them checked.
Yeah. For me, the only carbs I get are like cruciferous vegetables, things like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Then you're probably pretty low carb. So that's kind of ironic. If I can pick apart what you were saying for a second, because it's, oh, I did keto, it didn't work out. I did carnivore, but I couldn't stomach it or something. And then now I'm doing paleo, but the only carbs are from cruciferous vegetables. Because it sounds like your version of paleo is pretty low carb. And so that basically it could be described.
I'm lying.
Okay.
I'm lying. Wait, I have black beans.
Oh, okay.
So I'm getting lots of beans.
All right. So I take it all back. So because beans are fairly high in carbs.
Yes.
Because I was going to say you're almost doing a ketogenic diet anyway, even though you're calling it paleo. But if you're eating a lot of beans, then that may not be the case.
Yeah, I can't not have beans. I don't know if it's because I'm half Cuban, but I need to have beans.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, but that's a good point. Like these labels sometimes with the different diets, people often put a label on a diet nowadays because there's different ones that are popular. But sometimes what they're eating is like very different from what it's quote unquote supposed to be within that. Or sometimes we switch from one to another and then don't realize we're still doing what the other one. So there's a lot, people are like kind of fanatical about different diets in some cases, but a lot of times they're maybe not even following it quite right or whatever. So it's kind of ironic in a way that people get is like worried about, or is this is the only way that you can do it kind of thing. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I know that I like off on a tangent. I went a little crazy. Like I had to know where my beef was made. I had to know like the farm, how they take care of the animals. When I eat eggs, I know the chickens. I know what they're being fed. I used to have chickens and we would feed them, you know, healthy things, things that we would want to eat. Like they would have the leftover grass-fed finished beef. They would have whatever we had left over. These chickens were very, very well-fed and happy. So then I felt more comfortable about eating their eggs and stuff like that. So I think that's kind of my take on a diet, is just know where your food is coming from, what it's eating, because that's ultimately what you're eating. I don't think anyone's ever named that yet. It's just, that's what I do.
Yeah. Well, I think that it has some names, but basically, I think that is really smart. And so we haven't really gotten into quote unquote what's, you know, the healthiest way to eat. But I think based on some recent conversations I've had and a book I read pretty recently, I've just come to frame it a little differently than I used to. And it's very simple in a way. It's simple to say, but not simple to do, which is I think the healthiest way to eat is to eat things that are in their original whole unprocessed form. And So whole foods, real food, so to speak, because a lot of people live on a lot of processed foods, things that have been ground up, crushed up in a factory. And usually, especially if it's some kind of like flour or potato product or sugar, then that's what's causing a lot of the problems I was talking about earlier with the high blood sugar, the high insulin, et cetera. So the eating unprocessed foods. But then another layer of that is trying to get away from the kind of industrial food complex, because the way that they produce things is often really harmful, not just animal foods, but also plant foods with the so-called monocrops, where they have these huge fields with just, they're just growing one thing, and they have to go through and just rid that area of all life, like all the little animals that would have been living there get wiped out basically when they're creating those, that form of agriculture. So if you can do what's called regenerative farming, where there's a more natural mix of different animals and plants, usually in a smaller area, and do it in a way where you're kind of rotating which parts you're using for different things, and avoiding, of course, like the huge amounts of pesticides and, in the case of the animals, some of the hormones and antibiotics and things of that nature, then that's another layer to the whole foods, is also know where it's coming from and not be using some of the harmful stuff that they do use in the big farms, basically.
Yeah. And I'm not super strict that I won't have something bad every now and then, but I am strict in that it has to be as natural and as from scratch as possible, because that puts such a barrier to doing it that you don't do it often because you can't, because you just don't have that kind of time in the day. Like, for example, I wanted to have boba tea once because I saw it on TikTok or something, and I'm like, this looks cool. I just want to try it one time. But then I'm looking at the pre-made ones and all the chemicals and the preservatives and the gums and the colorants they put in there. I'm like, I don't want that in my body. So I'm like, okay. So I made it from scratch. It took maybe 2-3 hours to make these stupid little balls. And then I put it in my tea and I'm like, okay, so now I know what it tastes like. It tastes good, whatever. But am I going to do it again? No. Because it took too much time. But now I know what it tastes like, so I can move on. Whereas if it was easy, it took 5 minutes, like the little package says, I might be having that every day. And then I might be creating a really bad lifestyle pattern.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, is that if you kind of force yourself to, well, because actually, like, I've talked about this recently on my own podcast, which is if you, some people like don't want to do any cooking. And so they just, that's why they buy like packaged food, prepackaged stuff, you know, whether it's a TV dinner or some other thing in a box where they just cook it real quick, or frozen stuff. But pretty much if you want to eat healthy, you have to at least learn a few really basic cooking skills. And it does not have to be complicated, because a lot of times you can just heat something up and it can take 5 or 10 minutes. You know, a few vegetables, maybe some kind of meat or eggs, and lots of other things. But you can just do relatively simple things, add some seasoning, and it can be really, really tasty, but also pretty healthy. And so what you said reminded me of that, because you're like, well, I try to make it from scratch. And that is like a pretty good barrier. Of course, a lot of people will bake cookies from scratch, and so it's still not good. That's not healthy. But if you're talking about something like boba, that's pretty impressive that you even did that, for one thing. But it certainly would prevent you from over consuming it, probably, if you're making it from scratch.
Yeah. Thankfully, I don't like cookies, so that's good. But yeah. And I also remember when I was very young, even though I was very unhealthy, I wanted to have, what was that called? Chocolate mousse. Right. So I had to get the cream from the Amish, the chocolate, like those very healthy dark chocolate. But I would also mix it by hand for like an hour so that I would feel like I'm doing some work, so that I wouldn't want to do it so much, because I do little tricks like that, so I don't get into like some sort of mindless consumption habit for junk food.
Yeah, well, that's smart of you, and that's good you've been able to do that. I think that's hard for most people, because the convenience stores and the fast food restaurants, at least where I live, it feels like they're on every corner, every single corner, or like almost literally every corner. So it's just so easy, right, to just step into a place like that, or even the grocery store. But since there are places like that everywhere you go, and it's just like nonstop, and the food is addictive. And so it's pretty tough. But yeah, if you can use like a hack like that, where you like kind of force yourself to actually make the things that you're eating, then even if you do bake some goodies, like if you eat everything from scratch, then you're probably going to have a pretty good, a healthier than average diet, let's say, at least.
Yeah. And thankfully, there's only so many hours in the day to make stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Have you heard of bergamot to lower cholesterol? This is kind of left field, but I'm thinking cholesterol, blood pressure, it's kind of connected sometimes.
Oh, to be honest, I'm not that familiar with it. It sounds just, I'm guessing that, is that like a supplement that some people use for that purpose?
Yeah, bergamot, it's the oil, the fragrant oil that's in Earl Grey tea.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I don't know much about it. I know there are certain, you know, supplements or things that can sometimes have an impact on your cholesterol. And lots of things have an impact on your cholesterol. Like no matter what you eat, it's having some type of impact on, you know, the different types of cholesterol and triglycerides and things like that in your body. But no, I don't know much about that one in particular.
Okay. Any other ones that you might know, like any herbs or supplements that are good to lower your cholesterol and or your blood pressure?
Okay. So no, I guess I would say I'm not super into that topic, but I mean, there are some things that can indirectly help with blood pressure. Cause we talked about at the beginning, like if you're like stressed, then your stress hormones increase the blood pressure to some extent. So anything that's relaxing. So of course, like sometimes tea, people think of tea as being relaxing. I know there's like, you know, infinite different types of tea, but like green tea has a couple compounds in it that I'd have to go back and look at the exact, but some, they can be beneficial in terms of blood sugar a little bit and in terms of body fat a little bit. So these specific little molecules in green tea. And then other types of tea are known to be relaxing in some cases, as long as there's not huge amounts of caffeine necessarily, which is not necessarily relaxing. But so that's one thing I would say is tea has some potential benefits in that regard. I know there are a lot of other like different herbs that people use for purposes like that. But I guess I would say I'm not really an expert on what herbs to use for like cholesterol or blood pressure.
Okay. A lot of people say you shouldn't fast if you're under stress, because it's going to make you more stressed, because fasting is a stress. So then it's, do you fast to lower stress or are you fasting to increase your stress?
Okay. Well, I think there's a lot of layers to that topic, because especially in our modern world and especially in the last couple of years, people tend to be stressed a lot, right? So the so-called stress eating is a more common occurrence, I guess, where there's this emotional component and people want to eat junk food, eat ice cream, eat cookies, eat whatever. And then there's the eating disorder called binge eating disorder, which is the most common one of all. It's more common than anorexia or bulimia. But of course, there's the other eating disorders, like those ones that were more famous, like the anorexia and bulimia, that cause a lot of issues if people have like body image issues, which is super common as well, right? Because everything we see on the movies and the magazines is, and now social media with filters and things, is unreasonable, unrealistic. So I think this affects women more than men. But so there's all those different components, just at baseline, just to begin with, they're kind of influencing people's thoughts about what should I eat? What should I not eat? You know, I need these cookies to drown my sorrows, but then I'm going to have a body image issue tomorrow because I'll see a magazine cover or something on Snapchat or Instagram or whatever. So there's a lot going on with that. I guess I don't really know the solution to all of those problems, but when it comes to fasting, it depends on your mindset. I think it just depends on your mindset. So if you're someone who has and this is hard to recognize in yourself, right? But if you have a body image issue where you're like, have unreasonable expectations about what you need to look like, then you say, oh, well, to get there, I'm going to use fasting. Well, you could have just as easily said, to get there, I'm going to like run a marathon once a week, you know? So you can do things and take them to excess and do them when you don't really need to do them. Like you could do a lot of fasting when you already are underweight, for example. And, you know, if you're already underweight, I don't think you should do a lot of fasting. And then depending on your relationship to food and your mindset about weight loss and kind of body image, maybe fasting's not the first step you should take. Maybe there's some other things. Like when a few minutes ago I was talking about trying to eat whole foods or unprocessed food. Because some of what you brought up I guess you didn't bring all of it up, but I brought a lot of it up. But if you're like stress eating, a lot of it has to do with cravings as well. And one of the reasons that we get cravings is because of that blood sugar spike and then crashing down, which comes after eating processed foods. And So if we start to replace, and you're not going to do this overnight, but if you start to replace some of the processed foods with things that are not as processed, with anything that's like a whole food, and that can include fruits and vegetables, nuts, seeds, you know, whole fat dairy, meat, fish, poultry, but eating those kind of things relatively unprocessed, then you're not going to have as many cravings. It's going to help control a lot of the cravings. And so you're not going to have as much of that urge to suddenly go out and, you know, buy a bunch of donuts and binge on them or whatever. And your stress levels will probably be a little lower just by taking out some of the sugar and replacing it with some unprocessed foods, because sugar has an effect on stress hormones as well. So I guess I would say if somebody's really struggling with any of those types of issues, from body image to binge eating to like feeling like they're so stressed that they're just out of control with food or something, then I wouldn't say fasting is step number one. But maybe after you switch out some of the processed foods with unprocessed foods and just get on that healthier way of eating, but which, by the way, if you have a weight problem, it's probably going to start going in the right direction pretty quickly just by doing that. But once you've done that, then maybe there's an opportunity then to add in some kind of fasting as well. But it's not like the first step if you feel out of control with things.
I do know that when I was very young, I would eat, like I said, tons of junk food. I was the quintessential powdered donuts just sitting there on the computer. Woo! It was great. But I had to break that when I met my husband, because he was doing functional medicine. He's, can't eat this. You're going to die. And I'm like, I don't know. I look good. But of course, it was going to catch up to me at some point. Mm-hmm. So I switched it. And for me to stop eating the junk food, I did a 3-day fast. Because that was the only way to get all the cravings out. So I was just in pain. Like I wanted to eat the junk. I wanted to eat all the stuff. And I just said, I'm going to let this feeling pass. And I noticed that whenever I got that hunger pain, if I just ignored it for 20 minutes, it would go away and I'd be fine again. It was like the time that I normally eat, I would get the pains and then pass. Mm-hmm. And then it will be fine. So if you just know that going in that you're going to have a little bit of pain and then you just keep on going and then it'll go away. And also I heard, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that when you have the hunger pains and you ignore it, that's when your body will attack the fat for energy. I don't know if that's true, but it's a nice thought.
Yeah, that's probably more of just like an illustration, just like a little mental trick or whatever to help get through it.
Yeah, I mean, but whatever works, just visualize eating all your food.
But I like what you said there about like the doing the fasting for 3 days. Sometimes they say it'll kind of reset your palate. So, I mean, I have to add all those disclaimers and kind of that context that I was adding a moment ago, which is because so many people are, you know, have those kind of issues, you know, with the stress eating, et cetera, that you don't want to just be like, well, the solution is fasting, because it just sounds like too much to them to like just do that all of a sudden. And then sometimes if they have this kind of, you know, bizarre relationship with food, then sometimes it can, you know, still be a little bizarre once they start doing the fasting. But you're right that if you do try some fasting and it maybe even, yeah, doing a day or a few days of a water fast, then it can certainly... One thing I've noticed is that the cravings go away. The hunger basically goes away after a while, because probably partly because my ketone levels are super high when I'm doing a long fast, and ketones help like suppress hunger and cravings and things. But anyway, just while you're fasting, like you will probably have this experience where the cravings and hunger goes away and unexpectedly, because a lot of people think, oh, I'm just going to get hungrier and hungrier. No, not at all. It's like the first day is when you have the most hunger, and then it just goes down from there. And then some people use the phrase that it resets your palate, meaning like you're used to having all this sugar and all this stuff, and then you give it a break and it recalibrates a little bit. And then at least while you're fasting, you'll feel more in control to some extent. Maybe not the very first time. Some of the times when you do it, you'll feel more in control than you're used to. And so it can be a really powerful tool, I think, even in as it relates to controlling cravings and just like changing eating habits. But at the same time, people are often worried that it's going to be a problem with like eating disorders and things like that. So it's like just having the right mindset around it is really important, but it can certainly be powerful as it relates to controlling the way that we eat.
I also like how when you do a pretty long fast and you eat something sweet, like a blueberry that normally if you've been eating, let's say, junk processed food, it's not so sweet. But when you haven't been eating sugar for a long time and you have a blueberry, suddenly this is like a magical treat and you're just like, wow, this is so delicious. And you miss that if you're constantly eating these processed foods that are just made with all these chemicals to like hyper-stimulate, I don't know, your sugar palates or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's true. And I think you can get that particular effect or benefit just by cutting out processed sugar, basically, or by fasting too. But like, in other words, if you go a few days without having refined sugars, like anything with added sugar, then the other things that you eat, the other sweet things in your diet, will literally start to taste sweeter, like the fruit that you mentioned. So they've shown that through research, I believe. And I've experienced that too. When I go off sugar for a while, then anything that like wouldn't be that exciting. If you give a kid like a candy bar and then you offer them an apple, they're not that excited about the apple. If you haven't eaten any sugar in a week and then you have an apple, then that apple could be really delicious, like more than it would have been if you had just been eating candy.
Yeah. And I noticed that. And once you have that, you don't want to go back to eating the processed food. At least I didn't, because I'm just like, why would I want to give up this feeling for something that's healthy just to eat something that's bad for like, that's going to ruin everything all over again and set me back.
Yeah. 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 I think that's the right mindset. And I think if people can kind of follow your lead in that regard, because anything you can do to get to more of the whole foods and fewer of the processed foods is usually the best thing you can do to improve your diet, basically.
So let's talk a little bit about what happens when you're fasting for your blood pressure, and how much fasting do you need? What types of fasting you need that can help with blood pressure, things like that?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because of course that's, you know, our main topic, so to speak. But so what about fasting for blood pressure? So at the beginning, I explained a little bit about how having excessively high insulin levels, which go along with high blood sugar and diabetes, or pre-diabetes or what have you, anything that's kind of going in that direction, tend to cause high blood pressure. And that's probably the most common cause. So anything you can do to lower your insulin levels and lower your blood sugar levels will tend to help lower blood pressure. So how much fasting does it take, or what kind of fasting should you do? Well, that's really kind of a dealer's choice, because in some ways it doesn't really matter how you start as long as you do start. You know, so if you're overweight and you have high blood pressure, fasting is probably a really valuable tool to you to be able to lower your blood pressure and potentially get off medications. Every case is different, but I tend to recommend to people that they start slowly just so it's more sustainable. Start with something relatively simple and relatively easy. Because if we're like, oh, you got to fast for 3 days, you know, twice a month, then like, yeah, that would probably help a lot. But that, for most people, that sounds too intimidating to like do these multi-day fasts. I mean, you can work your way up to it and it's not as intimidating as it sounds. But for most people, it just seems like too much to bite off at the beginning. So I think probably a good first step, and I don't know if you've heard of Megan Ramos. She's like a coach kind of that. She works with Dr. Jason Fung, who's a little more famous, but he and Megan Ramos have been working together for many years in their clinics, where they've helped people use fasting to kind of reverse diabetes and lose weight and all these different things. So she talks about the first step of fasting. If you want to start and you've never done it before, the first step is to stop snacking. So just cut out the snacks and to focus on having good, high quality meals with, you know, plenty of protein and some healthy fats, things that are going to keep you satisfied for a long time. Don't try, you know, to just eat these tiny little meals. Have a proper meal, but then cut out the snacks in between. And then you're doing mini fasts in between, like a mini fast in between breakfast and lunch, a mini fast in between lunch and dinner. And then, which might be like 5 hours, you know, in between those meals. But then if you were to not have any snacks after dinner, then that would take you all the way to the next day and might be about 12 hours. So you're already doing a 12-hour overnight fast, and which at that point you could call it intermittent fasting, because, you know, if once you get to 12 hours, that kind of fits what people, the definition that people have. So I think that's a good first step. That you don't have to do it that way. Another option would be to skip breakfast once a week, But you could start by just delaying breakfast by an hour or two, and then later try skipping it. But if you did that just once a week, then you're doing something to just kind of get used to it a little bit and just kind of, you know, dip your toe in the water and see what it's like. But and how much fasting will it take to improve your blood pressure? Well, no one knows until you do it. But it makes a lot of sense that it will help because when you do some fasting, it helps to normalize your blood sugar levels and your insulin levels. And once that starts happening, then your kidneys aren't going to hold on to as much salt and water like they have been. And then once that changes, then your blood pressure's generally naturally going to go in the right direction. And if you want to have even more chance of your blood pressure improving, then you can certainly focus on some of those other lifestyle changes, like doing some exercise on a kind of consistent basis. Anything helps, any type of physical movement, and also working on really relaxing in the evening before you go to bed so you can get like high quality sleep, and just making sure you try to have enough time available to sleep, because sleep is super important for blood pressure. But even if you don't do any of those other things, if all you do is add in some fasting, you're probably going to see some improvement in your blood pressure. And it's something you'll just have to monitor as time goes on. Because even in the same day, like when we have patients come in with and their blood pressure is high right at that moment, we're often like, well, you know, it fluctuates all day long. So if you measure it again in 10 minutes, it could be different. So it's certainly not something where you can just say, oh, it was normal this time, so I guess, you know, we're good for the rest of my life. It's something you'll have to just kind of keep an eye on. It'll go up, it'll go down. But the general trend will probably be more in the right direction if you start doing some fasting. Maybe before that, start, you know, eating fewer processed foods, but then start doing some fasting and then start making some of those other lifestyle improvements as well.
One thing I wanted to ask you before we go is I noticed that when I fasted in the morning, I didn't lose any weight. But if I fasted at night, I lose lots of weight. So is there a difference between when you eat and the benefits health-wise?
Yeah, I think sometimes this is kind of personal. It might depend on the person. But there is some research about the difference between eating in the morning and eating at night. And the general rule of thumb, like it's more common to be the case that if you eat at night, and particularly like carbs and things that raise your blood sugar, when you eat at night, it tends to have a stronger effect on promoting fat storage versus eating in the morning. So there is that component, at least for the average person. So it's probably better not to eat close to bedtime. And so if you're thinking about doing some like time-restricted eating, or which is just another way of saying intermittent fasting, like shortening your eating window, then it's probably good not to eat after dinner, in other words, and to have at least a few hours after dinner, you know, before bedtime. Because there is, for some reason, eating at night tends to raise your blood sugar a little bit more and tends to promote fat storage a little bit more.
I also remember when I was under high stress in my old job, I got reflux. It was a terrible job and the stress was awful. And I noticed that if I stopped eating 6 hours before bed, I didn't get reflux. So I find a lot of my friends, their throat's always scratchy and they have stressful jobs. And I'm like, you could have silent reflux and that could also be affecting. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, well, reflux is pretty common, certainly. I do think stress can like make things like that worse. But, you know, when it comes to having a crappy job and stuff. But one thing that I think is useful to consider is if most people kind of eat all day long and that's like a 16-hour eating window, then once you start shortening that, you do give your stomach and the rest of your digestive tract a break. You give it more time to kind of relax and potentially heal. And a few years ago, well, about 4 years ago, around the time I was starting to do more fasting, I had some digestive issues. I had like indigestion where my stomach would just be kind of upset frequently. And sometimes I had some reflux that went along with that. And I can't say for sure, you know, what caused it to improve, but it did improve right around the time after a few months of kind of doing more of the time-restricted eating where I was shortening my eating window on a daily basis. I think the most logical version of that is to make sure you have plenty of time before bedtime where you're not eating, because then, you know, your stomach's empty. There's not a bunch of churning going on in your stomach when you lay down to go to bed. Because as soon as you lay down, of course, gravity kind of contributes to the reflux as well. But just as a general rule, like the more time you give, the more of a break you give to your stomach, probably the more of a chance it can have to kind of normalize things and not have as much reflux going on.
So if someone wants to try fasting, how should they start? And can you tell us a little bit about your intermittent fasting checklist and how everyone can get access to that?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the first step is kind of what I was explaining a few minutes ago, which is to have to focus on meal timing, have satisfying meals, and then see if you can do at least some mini fasts where you go all the way from one meal to the next without having any snacks in between. And when you're doing that, you could drink a little extra water, you could drink some tea. There's various things that you can use to just kind of tide yourself over. But like cutting out those snacks is a really good first step. And then there's other steps, skipping a meal once in a while, like skipping breakfast some of the time, or dinner, or having an earlier dinner. There's various different approaches. And so you got to pick something and just go with it. So I've created a check of all the things, basically all the things you'd want to consider before you start. And that includes kind of picking a schedule and thinking about what you're going to eat during your meals so they're more satisfying, and several other things such as adjusting family expectations and considering your medical conditions. So all of those things are on my checklist, and it has an explanation, several bullet points about each one. So to kind of explain what to consider and kind of some tips about how to approach it. So that checklist, I think, would be really useful for most people, especially if they're a beginner who hasn't really done it before, but they maybe want to get started. So that's on my website. My website is fastingwell.com. And if they go to fastingwell.com/checklist, that'll send them to the page where they can get that.
And how can everyone learn more from you, and where can they find you on social media?
Sure. Yeah. So certainly my website, fastingwell.com. And then I have a podcast that I started just maybe a month and a half ago. So haven't been doing it as long as you, but there's maybe 12 episodes out so far. So one of my goals with the podcast was to walk people through things step by step from the beginning. So I think it's very beginner friendly. And some of the episodes are pretty short, just, you know, explaining these early steps that you'd want to take with fasting. So that's something I'd recommend people check out. It's the Fasting Podcast. That's what it's called. And there's a link to that on my website as well. And then on social, to be honest, I'm not super active on social because I have some, you know, mixed feelings about social media. But I have an Instagram account that people could check out. That'd probably be the main one. I technically also have Facebook and Twitter, but I don't use those quite as much. Fasting Well, it's something like Fasting Well. It might be fasting_well, but I'll send you the specific info as well.
Alrighty. So I will put all of that in the show notes, and thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to the show. Please show your support for the podcast by leaving a 5-star review. Learn more about the show and what I have to offer you at catktb.com. Consider being a part of the new Patreon, where episodes are ad-free and you'll find extra bonus content. Send a voicemail question or email me. Check the show notes for more information. I had an episode a while back with Dr. Mona Fahoum of Feminescence, and we spoke about Feminescence, Maca Harmony, and their Maca products. And if you're a woman who's ever had hormonal imbalances, if you're trying to come off the birth control pill, or even if you're going through menopause, this is a natural way to help ease that transition and to help balance your hormones. There's nothing quite like it, so go to feminescence.com, enter code CAT15, KAT15, for 15% off any of their single pack products. And definitely go check out the episode. Just search for Mona Fahoum on my podcast and listen. You won't regret it.
This podcast is for informational merrymakings and metaphysical purposes only. Statements and views are not medical advice. This podcast, including CACA-TB, disclaim any adverse effects by the use of information you may have heard. Opinions of guests are totally their own. This podcast does not endorse statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications, credibilities, or sanity. Individuals may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to on the podcast. If you think you have a medical problem, consult with a licensed medical physician, not just the spirit of your ancestors while on ayahuasca.